Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in to the program once again. As we go through the cardboard collection, those that we still have and the ones that somehow got out of the collection, maybe mom threw them out. Maybe you're like me. You just got fed up with the tens of thousands of 1988 cards you had in your collection. And you went, "Bah!" And you found somebody to take it off your hands. Well, whether you're a collector now or a collector then, welcome to the program. We come your way every Friday at noon Eastern via Audio Boom and also all of our various platforms that pick up the feed. That includes iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry. We're also on Spotify, Google Play, you name it. You can listen to us on it. And this week we're taking a look at 1955 Topps. This was one of those sets from the 1950s that was missing from my personal collection for many, many years. Finally picked up a handful of cards at the Tampa Bay Card Show a few months ago. And they are not star cards by any stretch of the imagination. They are definitely common cards. And they are cards that we looked at yesterday. If you go to YouTube, just type in Wax Ecstatic 1955 Topps or follow the link that we posted on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains yesterday. You can take a look at these cards and you will see some of the features of the 1955 Topps set that really make that set stand out. And there are some great cards in that set. We'll get into details of that in just a moment. And also, we'll talk a little bit about some of the players that I have collected. And that's what I found most interesting in some of these older card collections. Yeah, the set itself, it's neat to look at. And some of the intricacies that make a set either really nice or not so nice. But especially from the 1950s, because a lot of these players I haven't heard of. And I'm a history buff. I'm a baseball buff. But there are some names where you look at it and you go, well, okay, who is this guy? Or why should I care about this player? But let me tell you, there are some stories that are pretty amazing. There are some that are pretty inspiring, too. I think we've had a few in the show this past few weeks when we've looked back at some of these cards from the 1950s. And some are actually rather shocking, including one that I've got for you today. One of our cards, it's a player who, let's just say, went through some trials, definitely went through some trials and prison time and tribulations. And you look at this player and you go, man, this guy couldn't get a job today in pro sports. And then you realize, no, actually, he probably could. Sadly, as some people may think, but we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Now, as I mentioned, the show is coming your way Fridays at noon Eastern. We will continue to have the show at least through the baseball season. I am considering, just a heads up, as hockey season gets underway, and that's my day job, and I've got plenty of work to do there. And as baseball season starts winding down, you know, the regular season ends this weekend, you're getting into the playoffs, we may be shifting in the off season at least to a show every other week, so every other Friday. And I don't think too many people will be too upset about that. For one, we're not having an extended rain delay like we did during my hiatus before kickstarting the program again this past July. But also, for those of you who are still trying to catch up on shows, I know some of the earlier shows ran about an hour long, and you know, that can take up a lot of your time. So, you know, if you're still looking to catch up with some of the shows that we have released since we came back in early July, this will allow you the opportunity to do that. So my plan is we've got this week's show. We're going to do next week's show, as promised. That will be released on October 5th. And then I believe it's probably in everyone's best interest that we scale it back just to every other week. So we'll have a show October 5th, then we'll have one October 19th, and then we'll have one November 2nd, I believe it is. So we'll go every other week. We will continue to do what we've done in this carnation of the, or this edition of the program. A carnation is a flower, but this flower is budding a little bit. We will continue to do random pack breaks. We've got a fun one for you this upcoming Monday that will determine the topic of the show next week. We will also dive into the older card sets, including 1956 Topps. I think we'll do that in two or three shows from now. And when it's appropriate, we will bring in a guest. I still have got a couple of them that are kind of in the back of my mind. We'll be reaching out to people who can offer some insight, not only into the card hobby today, the collecting hobby, but also the industry from the past. And we've had some pretty unique views from our guests, including the son of a former wholesale salesperson for Topps and Score in the 1980s, and also recently from Kidority Cards, a charity cause, collecting cards that they will sell to children in monthly packs. It's a different way, a different viewpoint of looking at the hobby, and we certainly want to try to mix in those interviews every now and then. So again, programming note, you've got this week's show. We'll do a show next week, October 5th, and then starting then, we will go every other week. So as not to overwhelm me, I've got a lot going on, but also not to overwhelm you too, because we have put out, I believe, probably 10 shows since we came back, 10 or 12 shows, and some people just haven't caught up just yet. Now, even though the show may be going every other week, our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, is always open. If you ever have any comments or questions about the hobby, about the show itself, even suggestions, they're more than welcome to post them at Wax and Gum Stains. I take all questions and comments seriously and certainly look into everything that is suggested. But also, we just have general comments about the hobby, you know, or about the sport too. And you are more than welcome to just talk baseball or talk baseball cards on there whenever you get the chance. So keep that marked on your Twitter page, if you will, your timeline. Give us a follow at Wax and Gum Stains. And don't forget to share with your friends that Wax and Gum Stains is our Twitter feed. And we've got a lot of fun stuff that goes out there. Lastly, one more pitch for money. And again, we thank everybody who has contributed through our PayPal account to A, keep the show going, but B, allow us to buy some interesting packs that we look at to break. You can make a cash donation of any amount. It could be a couple dollars, it could be 20, it could be more, what have you. It is at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And as I promise every show, every donation does not just go right into my pocket. It actually goes back into the program, hosting it on Audio Boom, keeping our archives alive and well, not just on Audio Boom, but all those other channels as well. And also it helps us buy some very interesting packs. And I've got a very interesting break, not a break yet. We're going to do the poll for the break. So we've got an 82 Topps Cello. We'll break that one out again. The 85 Topps Cello, which isn't getting much love. We'll put that out there again. And I recently purchased a few 83 Donruss Wax Packs. So we will slide a couple of those Wax Packs in there. And this coming Monday, you will have the chance to vote for your favorite. And the one pack that gets the most votes, we will open up on Thursday, October the 4th, and then talk about those cards in that particular set on October the 5th. Now, the set we're talking about today is 1955 Topps, and 1955 was a big year for baseball. It was a big year for America, and it was also a big year for the Topps Chewing Gum Company as they would finally put the final nail in the coffin of Bowman. And as we talked about in the video link, we compared the 55 Topps card to the 55 Bowman card, and 1955 Bowman was a great set. It is one of the most legendary sets out there, the faux TV frame card, if you will, where they took the pictures of the players, put them on this TV screen. Legendary and certainly well representative of the times, as television set ownership was going through the roof in America by 1955. And even though the 1955 Bowman set is a nice set and certainly a big improvement from what they were putting out in, say, 1950 or 51, 52, and certainly a worthy competitor, I should say, for Topps, even though Bowman was putting that good product out there, it was a war of attrition with Topps in the courtroom, where for several years these two were going back and forth with court cases over, you know, who owns the player contracts? Who has the right to go after this player? Does any company have a right to have an exclusive contract with a player? Who can put out a baseball card with gum? And, you know, all of these battles that were going back and forth. Well, the Bowman Company, which had exchanged hands from its original owner, J. William Bowman and Gum Inc. in 1953, well, the new owner just didn't want to take the fight to the courtroom anymore. And in 1955, this was the final year of the Bowman product, Topps actually buys Bowman, gets all the contracts. So that's why you could see Mickey Mantle again in the 1956 Topps set, because Bowman was able to snare him for 54 and 55. But, you know, Topps was able to basically buy out the Bowman brand, kill off the competition, keep all of their intellectual property, and for the next 25 years would have sole monopoly over the baseball card industry until the summer of 1980, when the courts ruled against Topps and opened the door for Fleer and Donruss to come in 1981, and then the flood of card manufacturers starting in the late 1980s. But this was a glorious year for Topps, because they put out one of their best cards, one of their best remembered cards. And with that said, I don't think it's the best of the decade. Some people will argue with me about that. But I have always put a vote in for 1956. And when we talk about 56 Topps, you'll see that, you know, that set is just far and above just a work of art. And of course, 53 Topps, which still has an impact to this day. But the 55 Topps set was a very interesting one in that it was one of the smaller sets in Topps history, only 206 cards. In fact, for the record, the second smallest set behind the 1951 set. And you were still dealing with the slightly oversized cards. They measured 3 by 3/4 inches and 2 5/8 inches. Now, starting in 1957, that would get shortened to 3.5 by 2.5 inches. But what made the 55 Topps even more special was the entire set was laid out horizontally. And one reason why they did that was because the 54 Topps set was so popular. In particular, the picture-in-picture, if you will, where you had the color photograph of the player next to a black-and-white action photograph. What they did in 1955 was they colorized the action photo as well. And by laying it out horizontally, it just gave the card a little more space to show off not only two pictures, but still to have a full color logo of the team that the player played for, as well as his name and his position and the team name as well. So it's really just a great layout. And the backs of the cards are also very well laid out, where you not only have stats and narrative, but you've got a big cartoon that takes up nearly a third of the card. It takes up the upper right hand corner, where you have either a trivia question or just kind of a goofy factoid about baseball. But on the white card stock, you also have the red, white, and green backs. And that was a color combination. As we've mentioned before, Topps utilized that a lot in the 1950s. You would see that again predominantly in the 1959 set. And these were color combinations that were also very representative of the times. We talk a lot about the color selection in the 58 and 59 Topps podcast. So if you go through our archive, look for 58 and 59 Topps, and you'll understand kind of the Mad Men appeal to those sets. So, you know, this was the pinnacle of the Mad Men culture, Madison Avenue controlling everything. And with the 1950s, it was all about pastels. That was the popular color palette. And as things kind of loosened up, I don't want to say socially, but as the 1950s became a decade that we think we know and love, the color palette opened up a little bit too, you know, after a very conservative time around World War II and post-war, and of course the Depression before all that, you know, opening up the color palette in everything in society kind of opened up things in advertising as well. And you see that with 55 Topps. You've got the white borders around the sides of the cards, all four sides. The background, you have a solid color that then kind of fades. There's a nice little gradient to almost white, not completely white, but almost white. And like I said, you've got the profile picture, or the mugshot picture, as you might call it, next to the action shot, all in full color, player name, team name, team logo, player position. Oh, and the faux autograph. Remember what I've said before about the autographs on these cards. Now you kind of look at them and go, oh, well, gee, how quaint. But the autographs on these cards, you know, unless you lived in a major league city or had a major league ball player as your neighbor, you never got the chance to get autographs from players. So even the fake autographs that was a special touch for especially kids, you know, in this time. So you saw the autographs used on these cards throughout much of the 1950s. Tops would get away from it throughout the 60s, and then they would make their return in 1975, I believe, 1982 as well, at least on the front of cards. Sometimes on the backs of cards in the 1970s, you would have the autograph thrown on there. 1980 as well. I forgot 1980, there were some faux autographs too. So a very well laid out front. I mentioned the back too. And with this horizontal layout, it not only improved Topps's overall design, but it also went head to head with Bowman. With Bowman, you know, putting out this TV set design, it had to be horizontal to make it work. And basically, Topps was still playing up to whatever Bowman was putting out there. So a little competitive juices being shown here with Topps changing for the horizontal layout, much like Bowman did. Now, again, we'll get into details about the 56 set a little later down the line, but I do want to say 55 Topps would then morph into 56 Topps because the 55 set was very popular. 1956 Topps, also horizontal background, also a two photo front, but you would have much more detail and color and like a full action shot, not just featuring the player in the background, which really made 56 Topps a work of art and arguably the best set from Topps in the 1950s. And some people will even say maybe even the best set in Topps history, never mind just the 1950s. So as I mentioned, a 206 card set. And while we've got some comments here, and this is a fairly small set, boy, you've got some big cards in here. The rookie set is incredible for 1954. The biggest one, Roberto Clemente, also Sandy Koufax. And Koufax was still a few years away from becoming the Sandy Koufax that dominated the National League for several years. But Topps took a chance on the young kid with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and it rang true in later years. And, of course, Harmon Killebrew, then with the Washington Senators, making the move to Minnesota with the team in 1961. And you've got some other big names from previous sets, including Hank Aaron, also Eddie Matthews, his teammate in Milwaukee. You've got Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, Ted Williams. The only holdouts, again, Mickey Mantle, because he had the exclusive contract with Bowman, and also Roy Campanella. But a lot of star power, not too many variations in this set, an award-winning design. 1955 Topps is an absolute winner. You cannot miss with this card. And even some of the common cards, like the ones that we have, are just outstanding. This is one of those sets, and I've, of course, always lauded historical vintage sets. If you have a few dollars, it doesn't hurt to go exploring the dollar bin at a card show or go online. You know, you go on eBay, you can find some lots of somewhat beaten up mid-1950s Topps cards for maybe $8 to $10, depending on, you know, who is selling it and what the shipping costs are. But if you can get your hands on some of these, even if they're common cards, even if they are just a little bit beaten up, go ahead and do it, because you will see when you hold these in your hands, you'll really get an appreciation for this set and the artwork that went into it. And I have to commend Topps. In 1956, they could have just totally pulled back. You know, they killed off the competition. They owned the baseball card hobby and would for the next 25 years. They could have just completely mailed it in, but they didn't. They put out an even better card in 1956, put out one of my favorite sets in 1957, which was basically all photograph, never mind just works of art, but some incredible photos in that set. And then some very creative, artsy cards in 1958, 59, and 60. You know, they really could have just easily, you know, taken the foot off the pedal and said, well, whatever, you know, we're the only game in town. But they didn't. You know, they continued, starting with, you know, the 52 set wasn't too shabby, but, you know, really the early to mid-50s building up a great set into not just a dominant set, because there was no competition by the late 50s, but really just an incredible work of art every year that they produced something. Now, 1955 was also a big year for baseball. For historians, you remember 1955 as the year the Bums, the Brooklyn Dodgers. Next year was this year. It was 1955, the Dodgers defeating the Yankees in 7 games. Finally, getting some revenge on their crosstown rivals, the dominant New York Yankees, the Dodgers finally get that World Series victory against the team in pinstripes. And I still hear stories to this day of people who lived in Brooklyn at the time or lived in just the New York City area. The town of Brooklyn was just ecstatic. And that's what I think adds to the legend of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Not only was it just that one time that they finally won a World Series and against the Yankees, no less, but with their departure for Los Angeles just a couple years after they won the World Series, that's really what makes it even more special and heartbreaking, a little bittersweet at the same time. They finally win it, but then, you know, they can only celebrate it for only so long because Walter O'Malley moves the team to Los Angeles, a very smart, shrewd business decision when it comes down to it, even though most fans emotionally will say that it was a huge mistake for O'Malley to do it. But he did it, and I think that adds a little extra emotion to what the Dodgers did in 1955. You also had the major league debut of Roberto Clemente, former Dodger farmhand. He was protected in the Dodgers farm system in Montreal. Some people thought that they were trying to hide him from the other teams, but some other people will say that, you know, the Dodgers were already pretty loaded in the outfield, and they were, so why rush up Clemente? The problem was the Dodgers were going to lose him basically to the Rule 5 draft, an internal draft, and it was the old general manager of the Dodgers, Branch Rickey, who was then GM of the Pirates. Because the Pirates were the worst team in the league then, he was able to pluck Clemente pretty early in that draft, and of course the rest is history. And I mentioned Koufax and the Dodgers as well. A lot of the, you know, stars of you know, the golden era of baseball, if you consider the 1950s the golden era, were at their peak. Not just Jackie, not just, you know, Duke Snyder and Gil Hodges and Roy Campanella and everybody else associated with the Dodgers then, but you've got Willie Mays, you've got Mickey Mantle, you've got Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews and Warren Spahn, and you go around to, you know, even teams that didn't quite have the magic of having their team based in New York, or, you know, the Braves were certainly not in that situation, but they had a great thing going. But Stan Musial was at his best. Ted Williams was having a late career revival in the mid-1950s. You also had, you know, Richie Ashburn. You had all sorts of tremendous talent from coast to coast. Well, not really coast to coast. Again, the furthest west team in 1955 was in Kansas City. But Midwest to East Coast, you had some tremendous talent in 1955. And a lot of the, I hate to say this word, but this is the first word that comes to my mind, a lot of the sappy remembrances of baseball's golden era of the 1950s kind of centers around 1955. It starts with the Brooklyn Dodgers and then just kind of goes down from there as to, you know, some of the talent that, you know, it kind of spread around the big leagues. And a lot of people get kind of teary-eyed when you start thinking about the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Giants. And again, you know, the Red Sox and Cardinals and the Braves, you know, those outstanding teams that they all put together in 1955. Also, baseball's move to the West continued. As I mentioned, in 1955, the furthest West team was Kansas City. The longtime Philadelphia Athletics finally moving out to Kansas City in 1955. We'll talk more about that in a moment, about a particular card we had some fun with. But the Athletics, with them moving out of Philadelphia, not only continued a westward expansion, which would culminate in the Dodgers and Giants moving out there in 1958, but it also started weaning out the two ball club cities. And it started with the Braves leaving Boston in 1953, continued with the Browns leaving St. Louis for Baltimore in 1954. You have the Athletics going from Philly out to Kansas City. And then eventually you've got the Giants and the Dodgers moving out to California, leaving New York City, going from three teams to just one in the blink of an eye. And the Yankees were the only game in town for another 5 years until the Mets came around in the 1962 expansion. So it's not just the westward movement of teams, but the long-held practice of having competing leagues in one city, National League and American League, was starting to go by the wayside, and one of the few exceptions was Chicago. Even though the White Sox were often on shaky financial ground. You rarely had teams that had, or cities that had two teams in them. Even the Washington, Baltimore area, they would lose their team in D.C. After the 1960 season. You had the new Senators come in, and then they moved out to Dallas in 1972, and there was a good 32-year gap between clubs playing in our nation's capital. So now baseball was not just going to new territories, but teams were able to start staking claims to cities all for themselves. And the funny thing is, a lot of the teams that moved in the 1950s were the dominant team in their former homes, say, in the 1920s and 30s. That was definitely true with the Athletics. The A's were the top team in Philadelphia really up until about 1950. Of course, the Phillies and their whiz kid group getting to the World Series against the Yankees, coupled with the falling apart of the power structure under Connie Mack and his kids who were fighting over control of the club, that hastened their exit out there. A lot of people forget that, even though the Phillies ended their time in Shibe Park as the main tenant, that park was built for the Athletics. The Phillies were down the street in the Baker Bowl, which was falling apart year after year, and they moved in and became tenants of the Athletics in the late 1930s. Same thing with St. Louis. You know, the Browns were actually St. Louis's team up until the dominant Cardinals teams of the late 20s and early 30s, and then really the nail in the coffin came in 1950, I believe. I think I've told this story where Bill Veeck thought he could chase the Cardinals out of town because they were on shaky financial footing. But then Augie Bush comes in, and you've got the Anheuser-Busch Corporation backing him. And that was the end of the Browns. And Bill Veeck knew it right then and there. And even though the Braves never really matched up well against the Red Sox, there was a little bit of back and forth in the power struggle. Boston was a very strong two-team city in the late 1940s. Of course, the Braves go into the World Series in 1948, but they just weren't able to make things work out, not only going up against the Red Sox juggernaut, but they just saw an opportunity in Milwaukee having the city to themselves as opposed to having to split time with the Red Sox, even though they played in two different ballparks. So you got a lot of movement, and that also reflected how America was living at the time. 1955 was a big year in America, as there was not just a westward movement of the population. You had more people from the Northeast and the Midwest moving out to, you know, Texas or Arizona, or especially California. You know, the California we know today really has its roots in the 1950s and 60s, just droves of people moving out of the cold weather, moving into suburbs. And in more of a microcosm, 1955 was a year of westward expansion, and that people, more and more people, were leaving city cores, downtown cores, and moving out to the suburbs. And you saw that with the ballparks as well. The Dodgers, you know, first they have to play in the Coliseum, but then they get Chavez Ravine, which was, you know, in the Chavez Ravine area of Los Angeles. But it was a big ballpark built around a giant parking lot. And you would see that more and more with the teams that moved out west. The Giants at first were in Seals Stadium, which was a city stadium, a minor league ballpark. But then Candlestick opened up in 1960, I believe it was. And, you know, that was on Candlestick Point. It was just out in the middle of nowhere. And you would see that with more and more teams as they relocated, whether it was the Braves to Atlanta. And, of course, Milwaukee, you know, the stadium was just right in the middle of a parking lot on the outskirts of town by the interstate off-ramp. But, you know, when the Braves moved to Atlanta, the same thing with Fulton County Stadium. When the A's moved again to Oakland, you saw that with the Oakland Coliseum. When teams like the San Diego Padres came around, Jack Murphy Stadium, just a humongous stadium in, you know, relatively barren land, just surrounded by parking spaces. This was the suburbanization of baseball, and you could see it in effect in 1955, not only in the ball field, but also just in American life in general. And then when you look at 1955, I've always found this funny. When you talk about the 1950s, the decade of the 1950s started in 1950. But for a lot of Americans, when you say 1950s, you don't think of much of anything that happened between 1950 or 1954. That's a five-year time window there. So it's a funny part of our revisionist history, we kind of, when you say 1950s, you're thinking of rock and roll and poodle skirts and convertible cars and the teenager coming to life. And you think of Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper and the Day the Music Died and all that stuff. We generally forget about the first 5 years of the 50s when you're talking about the 1950s. Well, why is that? Well, I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that you had more and more positive things happening, and a lot of them happen in 1955. So television, as I mentioned before, the number of TV sets owned by Americans really shot up starting in 1953, but was hitting its peak in 1955. You know, the television set was becoming something that you found in every home by 1955. Color TV was also being developed at this time. Color TV wouldn't really become a common thing until the late 60s and early 70s, but it was something that NBC was experimenting with, and they would unveil in the mid-1950s. So televisions are going everywhere. So a lot of people remember the mid-50s as kind of the start of the decade because the television became a regular household item. Also, movies were big. I mentioned, you know, 1955 was the dawn of the teenager. All of a sudden, there was a new demographic. In fact, the term teenager didn't really come to life until the mid-1950s. All of a sudden, there was a lot of attention put to these people who were roughly 12 or 13 years old, even past 18, you know, the age of adulthood, you know, going into their early 20s. There was this new demographic that people focused on, especially advertisers. And you had a movie like Rebel Without a Cause is a prime example of the teenage life in 1955. You had a lot of other movies, especially sci-fi movies, that kind of built around that. Also, automobiles. I mean, the automobile had been around for over 50 years at this point in time and became a staple in, you know, the 1920s, basically. But, you know, with a good economy and you know, recovery from the recession of the late 40s and early 50s, and the construction of the interstate highway, now everybody had to be in a car, and you had different types of cars. It wasn't just big old clunky metal boats that were being cranked out from Detroit. Well, now you have the fashionable Chevy Bel Air, which would become more popular in 1957, but got its start in the mid-50s. You also had the Chevrolet Corvette at the same time. The Ford Thunderbird was given birth at this time. And of course, as the 50s went on, you've got tail fins galore, the Cadillac Eldorado, the most popular, but every car, the bigger the fin, the more popular your automobile was. And then on top of all this, you've got music. Rock and roll was born in 1955, the Billboard music charts come out at this time. And what is arguably the first commercially successful rock and roll song, which was part of a motion picture soundtrack, Blackboard Jungle, we're talking about Bill Haley and the Comets, Rock Around the Clock. All of a sudden, in 1955, all of this is happening at once. So you've got televisions, you've got popular movies kind of, you know, drawing in the teenager crowd. You've got automobiles that are also drawing in teenagers. You've got rock music at this exact same time. You also have social movements. You're at, you know, the height of the Red Scare in the 1950s with, you know, everyone looking over their shoulder for communists in their neighborhood. You also have, you know, thanks to Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, you start having the dominoes tipping in the civil rights movement. And of course, the Montgomery bus boycott happening in 1955, too. So you've got some positive things. You've got some challenging things. You've got some scary things. Everything just kind of mushrooms in 1955. And speaking of mushroom clouds, you know, everyone's afraid of the atomic bomb in 1955. So all of these social things are just happening at once in this particular year. And I think that's why so many people go back, when you say 1950s, the first thing they think of is stuff that happened in 55 or 56 or 57, something like that. You don't think of, you know, oh, well, I remember this happened in 1952. You know, it's just funny how, as a society, we have, generally speaking, have just blocked out the first 5 years of the 1950s. Now, part of it, too, is revisionist history. There weren't too many of the television shows that were recorded or that aired in the early 1950s that were actually recorded on kinescopes. So we have very little track record of some of the live events that were going on then. But also TV shows like Happy Days. Happy Days didn't happen in 1951. You know, that was the more cheerful late 50s. Also movies, you know, American Graffiti, in particular for 1955, Back to the Future. The movie was drilled around that 1 year. And I don't think it's just because it was conveniently released 30 years after 1955, but because of all those social changes that are going on at the time, it was the perfect point in time to center the whole story of the movie around. So it's just really funny how 1955 is often seen as the first year of the 1950s. The only time a TV show or a movie about the 1950s happens before 1955 is MASH. And that's because it was the Korean War. They had to go from 1950 to 1953. So I've always thought that was kind of funny how Americans in general, when you talk about the 1950s, the memory goes as far back to 1955, and that's about it. They kind of conveniently skip over the first 5 years where you're dealing with, you know, the exchange of the Harry Truman administration to Dwight Eisenhower, and you're going from a pre-TV world into a, you know, every television had a household. You're going from black and white movies to color films. It's just so funny that a lot of people just kind of gloss over those years, and we kind of start over in the 1950s. Or 1955, I should say. Well, let's take a look at 1955 tops. I've got a few cards in particular, and the first one is this Charlie Bishop card. And we had some fun on Twitter via the Wax and Gum Stains account. When I was looking at these cards and doing a little research on some of these players, I looked at the Charlie Bishop card and I said, wait a minute. I don't think the Athletics used this particular cap their first year in Kansas City. And you look at the card, and it's a navy blue cap with the letters K and C on the front. The K is written in red, and the C is written in white. And I looked it up, and sure enough, I was right. The Athletics, when they moved from Philadelphia, kept the navy blue cap with the white A, the script A, if you will. They kept that on their hat until 1960. In fact, they didn't involve the letters K and C on their hats until 1961. And even when they did, 1 year it was all red K and C, and 1 year it was all white K and C. And then in 1963, they went with the green and gold attire sparked by Charlie Finley, the team's owner at that time. So I just kind of threw the question out there to Paul Lucas and Phil Hacken of UniWatch, and I just said, you know, well, this seems a little odd. The Athletics didn't use this hat, yet Topps penciled this in. And thanks to a lot of contributions from other Twitter followers, not just of Wax and Gum Stains, but just the Twitter universe, as this was retweeted out several times, a lot of people thought, well, the hat looks an awful lot like the Kansas City Blues hat. That was the farm club for the Yankees before the Athletics moved there in 1955. And the Blues did have a dark blue hat with a white K and C, but they never had a red and white K and C. Well, the one team that did have red and white as their primary colors was the Kansas City Monarchs, the very successful Negro League team. And, of course, the Negro Leagues were winding down in the mid-1950s, but they didn't really have a hat that matched what was on this particular card. And by pure chance, three of these cards that I purchased at the flea market all had the same hat design. So Topps decided to just mock up these Athletics cards with this hat design that wasn't in existence. And in fact, Keith Olbermann, noted Topps historian, chimed in on the conversation and said, I don't know what the confusion is. They weren't even selling these at the local stores. And he found a copy of an ad of a local department store in Kansas City trumpeting the arrival of Major League Baseball, I think Christmas 1954, this was the ad. And it was, you know, come get your athletics hats. And it was basically the Philadelphia Athletics hat. So I'm curious what the whole story is here, but it seems like in 1955, Topps went out on a limb and said, well, the A's are going to marry the Kansas City Blues and the Kansas City Monarchs hats and come up with this combined logo where you have the red and white of the Monarchs along with the blue of the Blues, and that's what they're going to look like, which was, as history would show, not exactly accurate. So even though in the case of Charlie Bishop, who doesn't really stand out in his baseball career, this particular card does, as it's evidence that Topps got it all wrong. I don't know who tipped him off that this might be the way that the Athletics were going, but they did correct it in 1956, of course, basically just using stock photos from 1955, where the Athletics hat didn't really change that much. In fact, the uniform didn't change all that much between Philadelphia and Athletic, or between Philadelphia and Kansas City in that first season. Now, as for Charlie Bishop, he was a guy who stood out in minor league ball, actually pitched a no-hitter in the Piedmont League in 1948, but he didn't really fare too well after a pretty good debut. He was 2-2 in his rookie season, for starters, shut out the Boston Red Sox in his first start in 1953, and then goes a phenomenal 3-14 down the stretch and goes from the starters rotation to the bullpen, where his career would wrap up after just a few years. He had a four-season career in Major League Baseball. But I don't think that's much to Charlie Bishop's fault. I think that's really more an issue of the Philadelphia / Kansas City Athletics at that time. So even though Charlie Bishop's career is not all that interesting, I do think the card that he's on is interesting. Now, the next card here is probably the biggest star card that I have of this particular set, and it's Jim Hegan. Jim Hegan was one of the best catchers, and some will argue the best catcher, in the major leagues in the late 40s and early 1950s. And the Cleveland Indians, who had an outstanding pitching staff at that time, of course, Bob Feller, Early Wynn, numerous others who went through the rotation over several years. While the pitching staff gets all the credit, the pitching staff itself and former Indians owner Bill Veeck would credit Jim Hegan for making the pitching staff so good. He was not only good at framing pitches, but also was outstanding defensively. He was actually a pretty good batter as well. Had a little pop in his bat, could drive in some runs. But he was able to make a pretty long career of it as he played over 19 years, mostly with the Indians, later bouncing around with the Tigers, Phillies, Giants, and Cubs. And with the Cubs, that is actually how he got into the coaching career. He was basically, almost retired at this point in time, but Lou Boudreau, who was a coach for the Cubs, basically pulled him in as a bullpen coach later with Chicago and then the Yankees. And Jim Hegan actually helped mentor Thurman Munson, also Rick Dempsey there. And basically from the early 1970s on, Jim Hegan was attached to the hip with Ralph Houk. Wherever Ralph Houk was, that's where Jim Hegan was. And Hegan unfortunately passed away in 1984 due to a heart attack. He was only 63 years old. Now, the name Hegan may ring a bell, especially for people in Cleveland now, not just because of Jim Hegan, but because of his son, Mike Hegan. Hegan was an all-star first baseman, played 13 years in the big leagues, including a few years with the Yankees while his dad was the bullpen coach, and later on he would become a color commentator for Indians television broadcast. Unfortunately, he too passed away from heart failure in 2013. So I would say this is probably the biggest star card, if you will. Hegan, a five-time All-Star, won the World Series three times, once as a player, twice as a coach, and he is in the Cleveland Indians Hall of Fame. Now, I've got an interesting card here, not necessarily because of the career. In fact, the career of this young man wasn't very lengthy. He was in the big leagues just for a couple of years. A win-loss record of 3-4, an earned run average of 5.27, and was with the Phillies just for three seasons. Thornton Kipper. Now, I just love that name. Thornton Kipper. Not too many people are naming their kid Thornton. But Thornton Kipper came out of Bagley, Wisconsin, and was a huge star in the college ranks. So his pro career didn't go all well, but he was one of the top pitchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. In fact, caught the attention of a lot of people in the late 1940s, went 11-1 from 1949 through 1950, and also went 5-0 in the Big Ten Conference. Got a couple of wins in the 1950 College World Series. Really was an absolute stud. And the Kansas City Athletics minor league system picked him up after his time in Philadelphia. And he bounced around, played in the Caribbean League for a while. And when his pro career ended, he moved on to a paper mill job in Lewiston, Idaho. But he would also keep the game in his blood as a coach. He was a pitching coach at both Lewis Clark State College and Phoenix's Mountain Point High School. He would die in Scottsdale, Arizona at the age of 77 in 2006. So Thornton Kipper, a unique name and a unique career, especially when you're looking at how he was an absolute stud in college. The Phillies jumped on him, wasn't able to make much of a career of it, and then just kind of bounced around in the minor leagues before settling on down as a coach after his duties at a paper mill. Now let's take a look at Johnny Gray, another one of those Kansas City Athletics cards with the wrong hat on it. He played for the A's in Philadelphia and Kansas City, later on played in Cleveland, and went back to Philadelphia in 1958. Now, he was originally signed by the New York Yankees and played his minor league ball in Kansas City. So he's one of those players who went from a minor league stint in a city to a major league stint in the same city with a different team. Very similar to what happened with Johnny Logan and the Milwaukee Braves, like we pointed out in a show a few weeks ago. Logan played for the Milwaukee Brewers in the American Association, and then when the Braves moved from Boston to Milwaukee and they parted ways with Alvin Dark, well, you know, Logan was able to just move right on up and was a key part of that Braves infield in the 1950s. But even though he was part of the Yankees system and put up a pretty decent number while in the Yankees system, once you got to the Philadelphia Athletics and later Kansas City Athletics, that was often the touch of death. In fact, he went 3-15 with a 7.25 earned run average in his two stints with Kansas City before moving on to Cleveland and Philadelphia, although he did manage a three-hit shutout against Baltimore in 1957 before his major league career ended. Now, following his pro career, he worked as an apartment complex manager in Miami and lived in the Palm Beach area for a very, very long time. And he also was part of the Rollins College Hall of Fame, as Rollins College was his alma mater. He was born and raised in West Palm Beach, so he went back to home. He passed away in Boca Raton at the age of 87, and because of his time in the U.S. Army, was buried with full military honors. And again, it's something that's easy to forget. A lot of these players, you know, having to play their careers around either World War II or the Korean War, depending on how old they were at the time. Charlie White, as we go to the Milwaukee Braves, Charlie White was another one of those players who stood out in the Negro Leagues, also stood out in the minor leagues, and was one of the first colored players in Milwaukee. Of course, Hank Aaron is the better known one, but after a storied career in the Negro Leagues, gets his chance with the Braves in 1954 and 1955. The problem is he got stuck behind Del Crandall, who was just an absolute anchor behind the plate. So even though he stood out in the Negro Leagues, he was also part of the St. Louis Browns farm club, Bill Veeck trying to help integrate baseball even more. And you know, Bill Veeck was big in bringing Larry Doby in as the first black player in the American League in 1947. Even though he was a top prospect for the Browns for many years and had a crack at Milwaukee, you know, with Del Crandall there was just no chance. And he had a very brief pro career. In fact, just 62 games in his big league career, 29 hits, 5 doubles, and 1 home run. But that was a very special home run as well. In fact, a solo home run in the top of the 13th inning as the Braves topped the St. Louis Cardinals on April 23rd, 1954. So the home run puts the Braves ahead, and there's this back and forth duel that goes into extra innings in 14 innings. He was able to help get the Braves two extra innings and eventually that win, as he was also catching in that game, giving Del Crandall a break. But not too many breaks going the way of Charlie White, unfortunately, as his major league career wrapped up in 1955. And he passed away in Washington in 1998 at the age of 70. A couple more cards here. We've got Spook Jacobs, a very interesting nickname here. If you're wondering, Spook Jacobs' name is actually Forrest Vandergrift Jacobs. That's another name, much like Thornton Kipper. Forrest Vandergrift is not a very common name nowadays. Now, here he is, again, another Kansas City Athletic player with the wrong cap here. Got his career started in Philadelphia with the A's. Very brief career. He would play through 1956 with the Pittsburgh Pirates. But what's interesting about him is that even though he had a very short stint in baseball, it was a career that certainly gained the attention of other teams and his nickname, Spook, because this guy was what we call a slap hitter. He would just smack a ball here, smack a ball there, yet he was fast enough to get on base. And basically, the nickname Spook came out of the idea that, you know, when he hit the ball, he would spook other players. You know, he would spook pitchers with these, you know, little worm burners that somehow he was able to beat out and get on base. So that's the interesting story of Spook Jacobs. Jim Tremel is the second to last card we have here. He was nicknamed not Spook, but Mumbles. Now, I don't have any particular story as to why he was nicknamed Mumbles, but I'm just going to guess that he didn't really speak loud enough, and that just may be the case. He also had a very brief playing career, 3 years, all with the Chicago Cubs, mostly a relief pitcher in his career, and he worked 57 games overall. And after his pro career ended in 1959, he spent 31 years with the SKF Corporation in Altoona, Pennsylvania, and he received a plaque honoring his legacy in the game, and he is inducted in the Cambria County Sports Hall of Fame. Now, Cambria County, where is that? That would be Johnstown, Pennsylvania, better known for the Johnstown Jets hockey team, the inspiration between the Johnstown Chiefs and the movie Slapshot. But if you go around the Cambria County Sports Hall of Fame, which I believe is in the Cambria County War Memorial Arena, he was inducted there in 2002, passed away in nearby Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania in 2013. And last but certainly not least, this was the story that just totally blew my mind. Jim Rivera. So I kind of skipped ahead here, but here's the Jim Rivera card. And Jim Rivera is quite the story. First, he was called Jungle Jim. Why? Because, well, he was such a big guy. He had a very big stature. Muscular guy, good-looking guy, too. And, you know, his real name was Manuel Joseph Rivera. Jim was his nickname, but more people called him Jungle Jim over the years. Actually passed away not that long ago, this past November, and he was up there, too, 96 years old. Now, Jim Rivera is the player that I said earlier in the podcast, where when I first did a little research on him, I said, this guy would never get a job in pro sports these days. And then I corrected myself and I said, no, actually he would. And some people won't like that he would, but here's the story behind Jungle Jim Rivera. So in 1942, he is stationed with the Army Air Corps, and he is with the 3rd Air Force at Camp Barkley in Texas. He's playing baseball for the camp team. He's starting to catch a lot of attention. He was a very fast player, too. Good hitter, but really better known for his speed. Well, in 1944, he was charged with raping and assaulting the daughter of an Army officer after a dance at nearby Barksdale Field in Louisiana. Now, after a medical examination, and by the way, the storyline provided by Saber, so thank you very much to the Saber people for providing some of the details here. After a medical examination, the charge was reduced to attempted rape, and Rivera was found guilty and served or sentenced to life imprisonment. And he's at the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary but he's playing for the baseball team at the federal prison. And he's playing really well. And word gets out to Earl Mann, the owner of the minor league Atlanta Crackers. Hey, you got to see this guy who's playing for the federal prison team over, you know, at the prison. So Mann goes over there. He sees Rivera playing. Can't believe how good this guy plays. Well, Mann knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody. And Rivera's life sentence is reduced to essentially 5 years. He's paroled in 1949. And here's Earl Mann and the Atlanta Crackers, and they sign him to a contract. And he starts working his way up, plays in the Puerto Rican League as well over the winter. And eventually, Roger Hornsby is coaching the team in Seattle, Seattle Rainiers, in the Pacific Coast League, signs him, and he is good enough to where he's the MVP of the Pacific Coast League in 1951, mostly for his speed, but again, he was a pretty good hitter, hit 352, scored 135 runs, and the Chicago White Sox signed him to a contract in 1951. Well, Bill Veeck, the owner of the Browns, now has Hornsby as his manager in St. Louis. They pull off a trade, a three-team, eight-player deal that brings Rivera to St. Louis. Well, word gets out about Rivera's past, and there are protests. People don't want this accused, found guilty rapist on their local ball club. So Commissioner Ford Frick has to step in, and he basically says, hey, he's already served his punishment. His conduct is just fine. We're not worried about him. But if he does anything in the future, then we'll throw the book at him. Well, he doesn't do too well on the field. In fact, he only plays with the Browns for a couple months, gets traded back to the White Sox. So he has a fairly decent 1952 season with the White Sox, but at the very end of the season, he gets in trouble again. He's arrested in the White Sox clubhouse on charges that he raped the wife of a soldier. Now, he says his defense was, well, this was consensual sex. He took a lie detector test, also passed. Chicago grand jury doesn't indict him. However, this is like 2.5 strikes here. And Ford Frick, again, basically says he's on indefinite probation. He's got to clean his life up. And boy, one more time and you're out, buddy. So he had a really solid 1953 season and would go on to have a pretty good career all throughout the late 1950s and into the early 1960s when Minnie Mignoso showed up. A little younger, a little faster, basically replacing Jim Rivera in the outfield. And then he would go on to play again in the Puerto Rican League, in the Caribbean League for a little while, played internationally, and then moved to Indiana and later to Florida. But since the White Sox stuck by him for many, many years, he remained very loyal to the White Sox, often showed up to alumni events, and was even with the 1959 White Sox team that, of course, won the American League pennant. Well, the living players from that team who were out for the pregame ceremonies at Game 1 of the 2005 World Series, the first World Series the White Sox have played in since 1959, Jungle Jim Rivera was right there. And like I said, he passed away not that long ago, last November in Indiana. But just an amazing story here. Man, you get accused of rape, and you're sentenced to life in prison, and you get paroled, and you're, banging around in the minors, and then, finally a big league job opens up. So that couldn't happen today. That wouldn't work today. And then I thought, no, actually, sadly, it wouldn't. And you think about, what's headlines nowadays? Addison Russell, Jameis Winston, Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee. You've got all of these stories and the Me Too movement going on. And it's kind of a sad reminder that when you look back and go, okay, this incident that happened over 70 years ago, boy, this guy, it couldn't happen today. He couldn't get a job today. Oops. Well, Actually, he probably could. And I think that's not just necessarily a sign of the times, but a sign of the lack of progress we've had in this particular field. So the interesting story of Jungle Jim Rivera, again, mind-boggling, accused of attempted rape, found guilty, sentenced to life in prison, but the local minor league ball club owner basically gets him out of jail early, and he's able to start a very lengthy career in the major leagues and had a long-term attachment to the Chicago White Sox even after his career. So some very interesting stories, some disturbing ones as well in this lot of 1955 Topps cards, but a fun lot to look back at. And a great set for the many reasons that I've described. And like I said, a lot of Americans, for whatever reason or reasons, seem to think the 1950s started in 1955. And if you're one of those people, the 1955 Topps set is a good place to start. As I said, if you can find some that are not terribly beaten up and available for a good price, absolutely get your hands on them and buy them. Now, we'll take a look at 1956 Topps in a few weeks. Don't forget, next week, we'll do another pack break. We'll put up the poll on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gumstains on Monday for the 82 Topps Cello, 83 Donruss packs. We'll have two of them. And the 85 Topps Cello, you can make your choice at which pack you want open. We will take the selection or the top vote getter, and we will open that up in next week's show. So we will have a show on Friday, October 5th. And then as the playoffs are getting going and my daytime work with the hockey team gets going, we will scale back the show just a little bit in the off season every other Friday. So we'll have a show on October 5th, and then we will return on Friday, October 19th, and go every other week for the foreseeable future. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for looking back at these old cards with me on Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.